Great. I'll start at the beginning. My name is Samantha. Grateful member of Al-Anon. I was born in 1982 in Peralta, New Mexico, which is just outside of Albuquerque. And I was born into alcoholism. My father was a raging alcoholic. And he was bigger than life. He literally built the town that we lived in. There are streets with my name on it, my mom's name on it. Like, he named the streets and built the houses in this place. I have to accept that I'm being recorded. Accept. He just like took up all the space and was like, and then gone a lot. My mom was a very typical Al-Anon. She nagged a lot. She was upset a lot. I was her confidant. And she was Brazilian, is Brazilian. She's still alive. And he was an American. And they married each other, I think, for status and particular roles to be reinforced. And they were both wildly disappointed. They didn't get what they thought they were getting. And so for Brazilians, marrying an American is like very high status. My mom came from a very elite family. And he was a working class man until he made a lot of money in construction in New Mexico. And that was always a fight between them. She wanted him to have higher class friends and be more of what she thought a person should be. And he always wanted her to loosen up and have more fun. And it was just a lot of chaos. So, but there was a lot of great things too. I grew up on a big ranch. I had horses and lambs and pigs and donkeys and all kinds of stuff. I had a family. We were very close to my dad's family for the first 10 years of my life. We would rotate between my grandma's house, my uncle's house, and my house. And there were a gang of 5 cousins, and we would all like band together and go on adventures when the adults were busy drinking and fighting. And there's a lot of joy there in that, a lot of fun. You know, big family Christmases, big family reunions of like 1,000 people, not 1,000, but a lot of people that I didn't even know all of them. You know, and I grew up in the era where it's like, go outside, come back when it's dark, and played outside a lot. I have a brother who's 2 years older than me. And I like to say, I think it's true, he still hasn't gotten over the fact that I was born. He was very upset that I stole his spotlight in the family, and has been trying to get me to act the way he wants me to act for years, his whole life. So that's what I grew up in. There was also, so what came out of that was, I learned how to communicate through triangulation. That was the way we communicated in our family, through teasing and putting people down and through criticism. There's a lot of abuse in my home. It wasn't the kind of abuse that left you with broken bones, but you know, like for example, I don't want to cry, but I might. My dad would play this game. He would come home drunk, and he would make my brother king or me queen. And then he would do whatever we wanted, but we had to like tell him to do something to the other kid, like pink bellies and titty twisters and just hurtful things. And it always ended up with somebody crying, and my brother and I were always put at odds in these ways. And so I thought that's how you related to people, is through each other. If you were angry, you went through somebody else to get it done. And sorry, I just saw the chat. I think I'm fine audio wise. Speak up if not. I left. There was a lot of teasing and putting down, and I also didn't know that that wasn't the way to behave in the world. And I also was really confused about fun, because fun always came with an element of danger. Like, For example, I was driving speedboats on Elephant Butte, which at different points in history, it was a huge lake. I think it's pretty dry right now. And, you know, I was like five and at the helm of a speedboat while my dad was drunk in the back, and I could have capsized us. And I knew it didn't feel safe, but it was also really fun. And so, you know, I was wary of fun. I was wary of most things leaving that. And my dad, the savings and loans crisis happened in the late 80s. And my dad had also been, was a crook, I think, in business. And between those two things, we went from being very rich to having cars repoed and losing the house he had built from the bottom up for us and having to move off of, to move away. And he, you know, in that bankruptcy, decided to get sober. And he went to AA and rehab, and my mom went to Al-Anon. And back then they didn't have Alateen in Albuquerque, I guess, or maybe we were too young. So there was like, the meetings were in this hospital, and my brother and I would go to art therapy. They had like an art therapist there for us, for the kids, because they were huge meetings. And so that was my first introduction to the program. And I remember that period of our life feeling better. But because of all the financial problems we were having, we moved to Kirtland, New Mexico, which is about 4 hours north and west of Albuquerque, to live with my grandma, which was a whole nother, you know, my mom was not happy about living with my grandma. We built a new life there for a couple of years. And my parents stopped going to the program at that point. And so my dad then proceeded, it was roughly like 1990. He proceeded to go through a dry spell and was not sober. He was not drinking until I believe around 2000 when he relapsed again. But we weren't dealing with him. And my dad was still, my parents were still in the exact same roles. And my brother and I, we were still triangulating and not treating each other well as a family. We did things, like we always had family dinner and my parents would make us go on family walks. My dad was like of the era where driving around was an important thing. So he would like all make us sit in the car and drive around for 3 hours, because that was like an event, I guess, when he was a child. And we didn't love it. So, you know, we did things together, but we never really connected or talked or had mutual interests or because we were always, you know, fighting. We were always kind of like making digs at each other. And it was, you know, all the stuff between my parents. And so then my mom got a job in Nebraska and moved us. You know, she pulled a Geographic and we moved when I was 11, which would have been, 1993, to Lincoln, Nebraska. And it was really hard. We went from being, as children, surrounded by family to not knowing anybody in this town where everybody had known everybody forever. And we were clear outsiders. And it was, you know, we weren't in, like, my dad was not, you know, I couldn't use his name anywhere. It just was a different life. And then my dad, like, all of a sudden wanted to be a parent. And I had a real strong reaction to that. I was like, no, sir, I don't take orders from you. There was a lot of fighting. My mom, didn't need to control my dad as much. So she got even more controlling over me. I was on like my weight and my femininity have always been a problem for her since I was like two. I'm not girly enough and I'm not thin enough. Even when I've been like as thin as I can possibly get, I was not thin enough. And so she like put me on Jenny Craig and we were always fighting. I was like, 12 years old on Jenny Craig, and they were like, we don't recommend this. And she's like, no, you were doing this. She needed something to control, and I became it. And he also, like, his Al-Anonism, I think, came out, and he was trying to control me as well. It was hard. And I became, I went from being moms, both of my parents' favorite kid, like, it was super easy, to the rebel. I started smoking. I drank alcoholically. I'm not an alcoholic, but I needed those kids to like me. And they were all drinking and drugging, and I knew they wouldn't hang out with me if I didn't. And so I would choke it down because I needed them to like me. I mean, I hated every second of it. I haven't had a problem with it since, but my middle school years and high school years were like college for most people. In Nebraska, that's, I guess, very common. That's what was happening when I was growing up there. And it was hard. There was no sobriety and no recovery in my house. There was a dry drunk and an unrecovered Al-Anonic and two very angry kids who had lost their family and the place they grew up in and each other. Like, after we moved to Nebraska, there was no more connection between my brother and I, and there hasn't been really since. Like, we had always been pitted against each other, and that move was the last thing that we had that broke us apart. So, and we lived like strangers. Like, we spent a lot of time together, but we didn't know who we were. We hid everything from each other. We still were putting each other down. It was just a rough existence. My mom was miserable with her job. My dad was, you know, went from being king of the world to he was an employee all of a sudden. And so everybody was adjusting and not doing a great job at it. And I decided, I started having really severe depression, and I tried to commit suicide at one point. I mean, I was never going to be successful because I didn't know how to do it, but I took all the pills in the house one night, literally anything and everything I could find. I think it was mostly like Advil and Claritin. And I threw up all night and nobody noticed. And then I went to school the next day because I didn't want to be at school, but I definitely didn't want to be at home with them. And so then I just moved on from that. And then I started getting in relationships that mirrored my parents. So I dated this guy who was 21 and I was 16. And there's a lot of sexual abuse in my story. So I'm just going to say that up front. I'm never going to describe it in detail, but I will just say, like, there was sexual abuse in that relationship. So this was the first consciously sexual abuse that I was aware of. He raped me, and the messaging I had got as a child about, like, you only have sex if you're married, and it's the girl's responsibility to say no and to not be in situations. And my mom was very as much of an empowered woman as she is, she's also a horrible misogynist. And so I just had all these really weird messages, and I thought I had to marry this guy. And I like became obsessed with him, and we were together for a year, and I tried to make that work. And then it didn't. And we broke up somehow. I remember how. He wanted to go out, I think, with his other girlfriend that I was pretty sure existed, but couldn't confirm. And I was insane. I mean, I was 16 years old and I was insane. And I put my car in front of his car. And I think I laid down in front of the other side of his car and I was screaming and yelling. I mean, it was like a scene. And then I like left and finally somehow he got away from me because I was the one keeping him there, and went out with his other girlfriend. And that was the end of that. you know, I was insane. And that's what, like, living, even though my dad was dry at that time, like, the family diseases of alcoholism was alive and well in our family, and it was crazy. So I decided I needed to get out of there. I hated living with my parents. I hated being the rebel. I just knew I wanted something different. And I graduated high school in 3 years so that I could leave. And I left when I was 17. And that was around 2000. And I know that I think my dad started drinking again. Well, my brother had left a year before because he was 2 years ahead of me, and I skipped a year. So he left a year before. Then I left, and then he started drinking again. And my mom just moved. She moved to Virginia to be closer to my brother. I was traveling for a year, and her enmeshment and codependency was so strong, she needed to be close to one of us. And she was like, you can come if you want, to my dad, and just left. He had started a business in Nebraska, and I just can't imagine being in a marriage of what, probably by that time, 20 something years. I mean, like, okay, well, I'm moving to Virginia. If you want to come, cool. But that's what happened. And so he was going back and forth for 5 years or something between Nebraska and Virginia to try to make it work, and drinking more heavily. And they hid it from my brother and I. And so I went out and did stuff for a year. I traveled, but I was in a program and I wasn't really by myself. And then I went to college. I went to college in Washington, D.C., which is where I still live. I have not pulled a geographic since my mom pulled the last one for me to this area. And started going to school. And, you know, I was a martyr growing up in alcoholism. I had decided I would be a martyr. And, you know, we would go back to Brazil every couple of years to visit my mom's family. And I remember about the time I was 12, seeing a kid who was younger than me, just so dirty and begging for food in the streets. And I was like, I'm going to fix that. So when I was 12, I decided I would work on fixing problems in Brazil. And I set out to start a career in international development. And I never reevaluated that thought. My mom was also wildly against it. She didn't want me to go to Brazil. She didn't want me to have, she wanted me to be as white passing as I could be, because that's how she survived. And she thought that's how I was going to survive. And that's what got you money and prestige and whatever. And so that's what she wanted for me. And I was constantly looking to be more Brazilian and more Latina. And she was like, what are you doing? And we were at odds about that, because I wanted her, I had idealized her, and I wanted her to show me how to be these things. And she was like, we're trying to leave that behind. And so because my mom had strong opinions about it, I was not gonna let go of that dream, even though it was the wrong dream for me, which I found out much later. There was just too much going on. I couldn't stop and see what I wanted or what I needed. So I went to school, I got a bachelor's. During that time, my dad's drinking got worse. We became aware of it, my brother and I. My brother also was in the army and was deployed to Iraq a couple times somewhere in there. Was really angry at me, I think, about it, because my dad had talked him into joining the army to pay for school. And they had given me some money for school, not a lot. I still have an enormous amount of student loan debt. But he kind of, again, we were always pitted against each other. And so he was at war and not happy with me. And my last year of college, I decided I was gonna, I guess I did pull a geographic. I went abroad. So I decided I was going to backpack through Central America in my summer. And then I was going to do a semester in Chile, South America. And So I was gone for 8 or 9 months. But that time in Central America, it was cell phones weren't like new. They were not something most people used. And so for the first time in my life, I was not in daily, weekly communication with my family of origin. Things had also really blown up. My parents, I have cysts in my feet. I have these big cysts in my feet to this day. And they're not operable. They just kind of break and then refill and break. But somehow my mom had convinced a doctor that I needed to have surgery, which I've talked to many doctors since, and I don't understand how I ended up having surgery. So she and my dad basically trapped me at their house for about 6 weeks before I went on this trip. And we played out this really sick dynamic of I was the patient. My dad literally took me to therapy every day. I couldn't walk because of my foot surgery. And he would take me and tell the therapist, pretend like he wasn't drinking and like he wasn't having affairs and like nothing was wrong with him. And he would drop me off at this therapist and tell her all the things I needed to work on and then leave. And then she and I would talk about, why do you think your dad's bringing you here? I'm like, well, and I said it, well, he's drinking a lot. He and my mom don't seem to like each other. And I don't know. It was just a bizarre thing, but I was in intensive therapy for 6 weeks before I took this trip against my will. And it stirred up a lot of things. And then I was caught suddenly not in relationship with my family on a regular basis in Latin America. And there was some beautiful gifts from that. Like my mom and I were very enmeshed most of my life until I began to rebel, but I had still kept a lot of her identity. So like she said things growing up, like, we don't like being outdoors. We don't like that. When I was in Central America, I was by myself in hostels and staying with random people, like meeting random people. And if I wanted to have friends, I needed to try new things. So like I learned that I love to hike, and I learned that I do love to be outdoors. And I learned that I could function. Like I had wanted to go abroad my whole life, and my mom always put a stop to it. And I learned that I was capable of being out in the world on my own. And I learned a lot of great things, but I also started to have dreams about my father sexually abusing me during that period. And I was really confused and disgusted, and just how it was a really hard thing to go through. But I was also like really enjoying the time and not being in daily communication. I had this like awakeness that came to me that I could engage with life in a way I hadn't maybe ever. And then I went to Chile, and all of a sudden I was very accessible. I was on email, and there was a house I was staying in, and they could call me every day. And I was, they would call every Sunday, and my dad would call in the morning, and he would pretend like he was at the house, but he was not. He'd been kicked out most of the time. And then my mom would call and pretend like he was at the house. And I'm like, but I just talked to him. It was this weird game that they were playing with me. And now there's this little dog barking here. I apologize. But what that did, being in touch with my family really put all my fight or flight back up. And my go-to response is to shut down and to be super depressed. And so I spent, a semester in Chile, and I slept through most of it. I went to enough classes to pass. I did my work. And every time I would have a little bit of life creep back into me, they would call again. And I would be in the middle of their fights. And I like missed that experience by and large, because my go-to mechanism was to shut down. So then I came home, and there was just more drama. And at some point, my parents were going to divorce. Many points, they were going to divorce. my brother stopped talking to my dad at some point, and he was triangulating for me. It was just chaos. So I graduated college and I got a job and I was bored. I really didn't know what to do with myself because all of a sudden I didn't have all the response. Like, I wasn't as busy as I was. I just had to be there like 45 hours a week. I was an entry-level job, didn't have a lot going on. So I found a guy. And, you know, I was going to fix him. He had dropped out of college because he couldn't afford it, but he was definitely going to go back and get his degree. And he was, he was a mess. He was gorgeous. He had beautiful long eyelashes and, was super popular. And we started, bickering like on week two, and I thought, oh, how romantic. and people would be like, you fight like an old married couple. And we were like a month into the relationship, and I'd be like, oh, we're so romantic. I don't know. I can go back a little bit. You know, like in high school, people would talk about their fantasies, and I never had sexual fantasies. I had fantasies about like catching the guy and him having to say sorry because he was cheating on me. Like those were my fantasies, because that's what I had seen a relationship was. And so I had this guy, and I had a baby with him. I was 23 when I got pregnant and 24 when I had the baby. And he's 15 years old today and hopefully asleep upstairs, probably listening. In any case, you know, and that was an abusive relationship too. Before the baby, you know, something would happen in my parents' house. Like my dad would get caught cheating with a new woman. And then it would happen in ours. He would get caught cheating. Then what happened, something would happen in ours. He stole all my money and spent it on stupid things. And then it would happen in my parents' house. And it was just like every week there was something happening in both houses that was like exactly the same. And I was like, oh my God, I've recreated my childhood. I was going to break up with him. And I had started going to Al-Anon. When I was in Chile, I started going to Al-Anon. I thought about going to Al-Anon. I couldn't find it in Chile. So when I came back, I went to my first Al-Anon meeting here in DC, and I walked in on a tradition meeting, and they were all talking about like service, like I put away the chairs and I make the coffee, and their shares were about that. And I was like, that's cute that they're talking about how they take care of each other, but they really should have, you know, talked about how you fix the alcoholic, because I'm here, I'm a newcomer. Like, that's so cute that they're talking about how they participate in the group, but they really should have turned the whole meeting on to me. DC has a really strong, people really focus on the traditions here. And that was my first bit of recovery, was like, I should be fully self-supporting. I got to participate in my relationships, you know? And I worked the traditions before I worked the steps. Like, the steps made no sense to me. I was like, okay. So that's how my Al-Anon journey started. I went for a couple of years, but I wasn't working the steps and I didn't have a sponsor. I got pregnant and I kept going until the baby started crying in the meetings. And then I stopped going. For a bit. Then I left my son's father. I stayed for a year to hoping they would bond, and that, you know, when I left, he would stay in my son's life. And then I realized he wasn't even trying to bond, and I was just living with somebody I hated. And that relationship also had sexual abuse in it, and it just wasn't a good scene. So I left. I went to therapy, and was going to, I got into grad school. So I was going to grad school. I was a single mom of a 7-month-old, I think, at that time. and I pursued on my international development career. I was, you know, I didn't know how I was going to take all these trips when I got jobs, but by God, I was going to do it. So I went to grad school and I don't know where I was at. Oh, and I started going to therapy. I would send him to daycare all day and I would go to do my classwork and do my homework and go to therapy. I didn't realize there were new meetings and I wanted to go back to Al-Anon, but I never found the time. And I went to therapy to deal with all my anger towards my ex, and his dad. And his dad, by the time he was two, had disappeared from his life. When he came one Sunday, he said he'd be back in 2 weeks, and then he never came back. I found out later he had another baby, and I guess he was freaked out by that pregnancy and had to shift gears. But the therapist I was working with had me start exploring the dreams I'd had about my dad when I was traveling, and they had continued. When I was graduating from my master's, I went on a trip with the graduating class. We went to one of the Carolinas, some big beach house, you know, that fits like 50 people in it. We went and we had this lovely thing with my parents. I was like, I can't go, I've got a baby. My parents were like, we'll keep the baby. And so I dropped him off and then from DC, their house and then wherever I was going, came back. And I've been exploring in therapy the dynamics between my parents and I. And I came back from that trip and my infant child, I was in the middle of a custody battle. His backward facing car seat was in the front seat, forward facing, strapped in. And I asked my dad, because I knew it was my dad. My mom would never do that. And I said, did you do this? And he told me some lie about, no, I put it there and strapped it in because it would be easier for you to get it out than out of the back. He never rode in the front seat. And then I went to my mom and she said, what was I supposed to do? I can't do anything. I can't control him at all. Something in me broke and that was it for me. I was like, I can't see you. I can't keep doing this with my kid. I can't put my kid, I was trying to protect my son. So I was like, this is the same shit. This is the same shit I grew up in and I don't want it for my son. And I left and I said, I need some space. And then every boundary I gave them, they broke. They took him out of daycare one day without my permission and disappeared for a whole day and then dropped him off just before I was going to pick him up. They just did stuff like that. I just asked for some space for 2 weeks and then they couldn't do that. They called every day and it kept escalating. And then we finally had this sit down with a therapist where I asked my parents about the dreams and it came out that it had happened and my mom had known. Even though I don't have concrete memories, it was very clear that it had happened. And my dad had abused me. And so I said, I don't want to talk to you all. I don't know when or if I'll want to. And then my dad came after me. First in emails and just in a lot of different ways. And so I was 26. I think my son was about 26, 27 at that time with a little baby and a job that barely paid the bills. And we had to move and change my number and hide because he was threatening violence and that he wanted to destroy my life. And so I came running back to program. And it was the most first step experience I've ever had. I felt like I was totally not in control of anything. I didn't know how it was going to pay rent. I didn't know how I was going to eat. And just every day, I just did the next right thing. And I called my sponsor at the time, just in total crisis every day. And she would read me a page. And I said the Serenity Prayer probably 1,000 times a day. And so I started working the program really hard. I got a sponsor. And I went almost 4 years without talking to my family. And it was the best 4 years of my life. I was becoming the mother I wanted to be. I was developing friendships I wanted, and it was all thanks to the program and having the space from the toxicity and the violence and the drama of it all. And I went to, you know, there were periods in there where I was going to 2 or 3 meetings a day. I was working 2 jobs and my son was like this little ball of energy and a lot of anger. You know, he was angry that he lost his dad, and he was angry that he lost his grandparents, and man, we butt heads. So it was just a really hard period, and I was able to like really work steps 1, 2, and 3. I would go to bed praying, like, I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm so scared. And I would wake up and I was still praying, because it was just so hard. And things started to happen, you know, like, I remember that period my car got stolen and I said, okay, higher power, this must be what you want. And it was Christmas and all the gifts were in the trunk. So, because I have this nosy, busybody little boy who wouldn't stay out of closets. So all the gifts were in the trunk. And I said, okay, higher power, this has to be what you want. I'm just going to take it one step at a time. And I was lucky enough to have a job where I could work from home at that time, because I couldn't, from where I lived, get to the place I wanted. I needed to work. And so I worked from home. And the car was gone 2 weeks, and it came back, and clearly some kids had taken it, and they were smoking in it and drinking in it, and they'd had a really good time in my car. It was really gross. But the Christmas presents were still in the trunk, because I wasn't going to be able to replace those Christmas presents. I just didn't have the money. And so I could just be grateful for that. Like, that was a total higher power moment. And I was able to just like, okay, this must be what's needed, because I'm still okay. Like, yeah, it sucks if I never get my car back, and we're fine. Maybe he won't get gifts this year, and we're fine. And then we still got everything we needed. I remember during that period too, I was really struggling. I hated my career, hated it. I never enjoyed it. Just wasn't what I thought it was. I didn't get to be the savior I wanted to be. It was a lot of paperwork. And it didn't match my fantasies of going and saving that poor, dirty child. They were being saved by somebody else and I was filling out paperwork. So I remember, like, I find higher power in nature a lot. And I was walking in this place we call, here in DC, it's called Rock Creek Park. It's essentially like a forest in the middle of the city, and you're walking and you think you're in the forest, and then all of a sudden there's a huge building. But you can walk for like a mile and think you're in a forest. And so I was walking there. I would walk there a lot with my kid. Did I have a dog? Maybe just my kid. And I remember I was like, just, I don't know what to do. I identified a new career path I wanted. I was terrified to leave the old one. You know, I had a golden handcuff situation. And this woman appeared, and she was in the career I wanted to be in. And she basically, like, while we were chit-chatting, answered all my questions that I'd been praying to higher power about. She's like telling me her real life experience in this career. And it gave me a lot of direction of what I wanted, like how I was going to move forward. And I was like, wow, Like, I prayed for answers, and literally this woman appears while I'm walking, praying with higher power, and tells me my answers. And so I really just got a lot during that time. And I also learned about myself that I'm a lesbian, which is like, I never had the space or time to think about who I was. I was too busy fighting off my mom's ideas and clinging to the first idea I ever had. I also, you know, didn't think relationships were supposed to be fun. I thought they were supposed to be fighting. And so I was, you know, made sense to me that I didn't really enjoy sex because, you know, relationships aren't fun. They're work. You got to work at them. And so I met this woman and she was amazing. And she was amazing until she wasn't. And then we had a year-long relationship. I found myself. I felt like I'd been raised by a bunch of birds and I was a fish, and somebody finally stuck me in the water and I was like, oh my God, this is what it's like to breathe. So I came out and just felt a lot of unity within myself. And so things were going pretty great. And then in 2013, my dad died. He drank himself to death in our family cabin in Colorado. Because of program, I got to do that differently. I called a lot of people. I went to a lot of meetings. I decided to go to the funeral. And I got a moment alone with his body. And he looked grotesque. I mean, part of that's just what a dead body looks like, but he was also probably in the worst phase of his life. And I was able to talk to him and tell him how hurtful he had been, and then tell him all the things that I had loved about him. And the last thing I said to him was, I forgive you. And I wouldn't have done that had I not worked on myself in this program. I would have been holding on to that rage. I don't regret not being in touch with him. I think it was the best thing for both of us. And I'm so glad I went and had that goodbye with him the way that I did. But then I didn't know what to do after that. My mom was pushing herself back in my life. And then in very close succession, my girlfriend broke up with me. We were talking about getting married. It had been about a year. And then she like went away on a 2-week trip and came back engaged to somebody else. My best friend, who was an Al-Anon person, so I was in denial. I don't know if you've heard this acronym. I heard it about a year ago and I'm obsessed with it. It's don't even know I'm lying, which denial is what I'm so great at. I can shut down. And so I was in denial. This really great Al-Anon friend of mine was a total alcoholic. She was in denial. So she was working an Al-Anon program and like calling me wasted all the time. And that friendship broke up and I didn't know what to do. And I stayed in the program another 2 years, but I didn't have anybody to walk me. The way that everybody I knew at the time was working the program was not a structured walking through the steps. It was like, what step are you on today? And so I was working the steps as best I could, and I just wasn't getting to the level I needed to. I didn't have the strong foundation I needed. I hadn't done a proper 4-step. I'd done bits and pieces of a 4-step and an amends here and an amends there, and just not like a really solid program. It was the best program I knew and I was doing the best I could, but it just wasn't good enough. And I also remember like on New Year's Eve, the night after my dad died, I was in a bar with my girlfriend at the time, and we were just talking about whatever, everything was fine. And the clock struck midnight and I could feel this like wave of sadness and tears coming. And I remember thinking, This is the first year I've walked on this earth. Tim Watson is not alive. That's my dad. And then I remember the second thing I did was, nope, I'm not feeling that. And so I shut down again. I also really didn't know if I had a right to grieve, since my brother was telling me I didn't, and I hadn't been in this life. And so at some point, a couple of years after my dad died, I left the program. I just wasn't getting what I needed, and nothing was changing. And then things got really bad for a long time. I went out, I had a really fancy job and was like the superstar. And I was just totally, I was a workaholic and then a rageaholic. But then I had this night in Paraguay. I would go to Paraguay with, for work. My boss came. He was out of his mind drunk. He was a raging alcoholic. And then we had like this, he basically assaulted me. It wasn't like a big one, but, and I broke. I was, you know, my son was out of control. My travel was out of control. I hated my job. And I was with this alcoholic all the time. He like took me under his wing, and I really didn't want to be under his wing. And then he, I was still dealing with the grief of the loss of those two relationships and my dad. And so I broke and I went into a deep depression. I left on short-term disability and did 2 years of intense therapy. And none of it worked. And then I met a girl. In 2020, that I was really excited about, And I was like, I know I can't do this without program. And so I came back because I really wanted to work with her. And I kicked my mom back out of my life. It was just too painful. It was too toxic. We were both getting worse in our relationship. And she'd done some things that were pretty awful. And I was like, you know what? We're taking a break again. And so I've had a year and a half back in the program and a year and a half with her out of my life. I think I have about 10 minutes left. So what's my program look like now, and what's the difference? I mean, I have a sponsor who I adore, who I only got to meet because of the pandemic. I was mad at Al-Anon in DC. I felt like it had failed me. I know now that I should have looked in other places, tried other meetings, done other things, but I thought I'd been failed. And so there's this list of queer meetings. And so I started going only to meetings outside of DC that were all lesbians and gays and the whole LGBTQ family. And I met my sponsor there. We started working together, and this person has shown up for me for 90 minutes every week for over a year. And we work the steps out of the big book, which I believe Tradition 5 says we can do, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I am not an alcoholic, but man, I think that's a great way to work the steps. It's a way that I've never, it's deeper than anything I did before. I'm currently between 6 and 7 in doing the steps that way. And my sponsor, that relationship has been transformational for me, because it's just somebody who shows up and loves me, whether or not I did the work, whether or not I am doing well today. I can even be mad at them. I've gotten to be mad at them, and we like had this whole thing and worked it out, and they held their boundaries. I knew I learned that I could trust them, like, and they were going to people please me, but also I could have my feelings. And then by the time I got to my fifth step, which I did in January, I flew out to Seattle to see them. I was excited to tell them what was in my fourth step. And I learned a lot about myself. I learned things like, you know, after I had my son, my suicidal ideation stopped. And one of the things that I learned in my fourth step was that I resented my son that I had to be alive. Like, I was living for him and I resented it. And like, that's fucked up. And now I can say it and like, I don't have to live that way anymore. And I could tell my sponsor that, and they just hugged me. And there was no confusion either of like, you know, for me, intimacy always meant sex and romance. There's no confusion there. Boundaries are super clear. It just feels really safe. And I left that fifth step feeling like more love is available to me in the world. I feel like there's just more available. And my life's still a shit show. I have a huge tax problem I need to figure out. My teeth are fine. I have the teeth of an 80-year-old woman because I don't take care of myself. And I'm working on it. But it's been great. And now I have two sponsees and some great Al-Anon friends. And, you know, my sponsees, man, they're both so hungry for this program in very different ways. And it inspires me. I remember just a couple weeks ago, I was having a day and I was like, I don't want to get out of bed today. And then I meet one of my sponsees at 9 a.m. I was like, well, I gotta get out of bed. She's waiting. I was wrong in a work situation, and man, I wanted to be an asshole. And I wanted to just like let them have it, write the board, fight the fight, And then I was like, I can't go talk to my sponsee tomorrow about recovery and act this way. And so my sponsor gives me love and acceptance and helps me work my program, and my sponsees inspire me to be better. I can't talk to them and not do better than this. They say, I believe this is a we program. And I do think some of that's been lost over time. You know, like what you hear on speaker tapes, I'm obsessed with speaker tapes. It's a major tool I use. It works when we really show up for each other, when we call each other, when we're walking this life and this path together. It's not something we do once or twice a week for an hour. For me, it's like all of my life. And I've gotten a lot of gifts, you know, like right now I have a dog who's dying. He's got cancer. And I've gotten to do that differently. I would have put him down by now. And we've had him an extra month, and we got to take him to the beach and play with him. And my son's learning how to say goodbye in a healthy way. I've gotten to, you know, just like my son was in this really dangerous school this year. And I know I need to wrap up soon, so I will. And rather than going and yelling at the principal, who clearly had no control over the kids or the teachers, I was able to see like what my real options were, stay calm, do what I could to make the situation better while he was there, and move him without all the drama, without all the heartache. And so my life's still a mess, but it's better all the time. And my ability to stay awake for it, because that's my go-to, is to just shut down and stay in bed, is so much higher and so much better. I was going to end on the promises, so I will do that. Let me see. The other thing that I want to say is do service. Service is whether you're sponsoring people, or I work on a committee for a conference for the queer community, like an LGBTQ conference in Al-Anon. Like, I get to work on my stuff there too. And my sponsor helps me with that too. So there's so much magic in service. So here's the Al-Anon promises. I'm going to comment a little bit on them and wrap up in the next 5 minutes. This is from Survival to Recovery, page 269 to 270. if we willingly surrender ourselves to the spiritual discipline of the 12 steps, our lives will be transformed. We will become mature, responsible individuals with a great capacity for joy, fulfillment, and wonder. Though we may never be perfect, continued spiritual progress will reveal to us our enormous potential. We will discover that we are worthy of love and loving. We will love others without losing ourselves, and we will learn to accept love in return. Our sight, once clouded and confused, will clear, and we will be able to perceive reality and recognize truth. Courage and fellowship will replace fear. We will be able to risk failure to develop new hidden talents. Our lives, no matter how battered and degraded, will yield hope to share with others. We will begin to feel and will come to know the vastness of our emotions, but we will not be slaves to them. Our secrets will no longer bind us in shame. As we gain the ability to forgive ourselves, our families, and the world, our choices will expand. With dignity, we will stand for ourselves, but not against our fellows. Serenity and peace will have meaning for us as we allow our lives and the lives of those we love to flow day by day. With God's ease, balance, and grace, no longer terrified, we will discover we are free to delight in life's paradox, mystery, and awe. We will laugh more. Fear will be replaced by faith, and gratitude will come naturally as we realize that our higher power is doing for us what we cannot do for ourselves. Thank you so much for letting me share. That's it.